We were finishing up the last chapter of Romans, trying to handle a subject that is really very, very broad, vast subject, and that is the sweep, the great sweep of where we came from, what we're doing here, and where we're going. And that just about covers the whole span of human existence. If we take a few nights to look at that, that's because it's a very big subject, and I don't like to just drop term words on you, or terms, and then run off to let you sweat them out. So we've been kind of drifting around in the universe a little bit to see where it all came from, where it's going, what we can use as a fundamental footing for our faith. I can't just walk in here and say to you, I know all about God, listen to me, and you're saved. All I can do is take this book and unfold it to you as well as I can. These are deep ideas. And the reason there's so much error in the church today is there's so much surface knowledge, or a superficial approach to things. Too much is assumed. Too much is taken for granted. So we've been talking for several weeks about the fact that we came out from God. And we started with the idea of spirit. We are spirit beings. And you hold that in your mind because that's the essence of everything. And we got that spirit being from God. And that's why we have some fundamental belief in the idea of God, because after all, we have something far more than the animals have. Things we're writing here, the instinct or the attitude of caring in the heart of the human being cannot be eliminated from man any more than the instinct of survival can be eliminated from the animal. The fact that we care about things, about people, about life, and this comes from the fact that we have within us God's Spirit. Otherwise, we'd be just an ecological process. Now, by that I mean animals eating plants, and plants taking up the soil, and just getting into an ecological process. And life would be going nowhere. But it isn't that. It is so tremendous. These human persons thinking, feeling, knowing, reacting, interacting. What a magnificent process. And all of that indicating that we came out from God. Because where else will we get it? You don't get this from a frog, you know. In spite of that popular television series, frogs do not normally act the way that frog does. Have you ever heard that? Isn't there a frog out there somewhere? What's his name? What's the frog's name?
Kermit.
Kermit, okay. Now, Kermit is a very remarkable frog, but he's not normative. Understand, you won't find many frogs that can do that. Where do we get it? We get it from God. There's no other place to get it. The intricate sensitivity of this brain of ours to put together patterns by which we can identify and understand things. And how many thousands of fragments of knowledge in this room? Think of all of it. Every single element, a brick, even a brick in that fireplace, can you think of all the fragments of knowledge that our brain has to accumulate to understand the meaning of brick? Now, a spider crawling up the bricks doesn't think anything but hard. But you and I, we can think of bricks, even going back to Egypt. And they made buildings, made their own bricks, made them with straw, made buildings out of them, and so forth. The history of a brick is one little element. But you look around this room and there are thousands of things. There are some posts there. It isn't only the wood. But they're turned on a lathe. You know, there's a whole art form involved in one of those pillars up there. Now, I've scratched the surface. There are at least 10,000 fragments of knowledge that you have in your brain relative to this complex of rooms right here. And you can even go down to the pictures on the wall, the things in the picture, the buildings. There's a dome there in that picture. Middle Eastern art there. Everything here. I think I'm being very conservative when I say 10,000 fragments of knowledge. But they have to do with more than peeling bananas and living in a tree. We could go from tonight, we could take the next year, every night, for an hour or two, and talk just about what I have started out here with tonight. It would involve us in the understanding of the brain, the psyche, the processes of culture and civilization. Do you think for a moment dogs or apes or fleas or muskrats think of those things? All right. And yet we've got those kind of things wandering around here in our society. The ape did not vanish before the approaching progressively more sophisticated entity. Apes are still around, still eating bananas, still living in trees, swinging by their tail. You have to be awfully desperate to get rid of God. Okay, now, the next phrase, we came out from him, and we live through him. Now there we come down to the nitty-gritty of what is life all about. And that's what we all want to know right now. You don't want to come here and listen to some academic treatise on theology. You want to know how to live. You want to know what to do with your lives. Okay, so the concept of through him says to us, if we came out from God and were possessed of God's Spirit, which is true, and if we then lost that Spirit in the fall, and then if through salvation or through identity with Christ we regain the life of that Spirit, then we have to say that all our living in this world today, our feet planted on the earth, is centralized, is organized around, if you will, the meaning of spirit. Apart from possessing in our spirits the Spirit of God, we're just marionettes, puppets running about. There's nothing to life. If the whole purpose of God for life is included in the concept of spirit, and if man lost that spirit and therefore that meaningfulness, and if Christ restores that spirit to us so that we can go on now as Adam didn't, you know, as he dropped the ball, so we can go back and now we can go on with God as people of spirit being, then that is the essence of our life. It doesn't mean that you have to be spiritual. It doesn't mean you have to be religious. It doesn't mean that every thought in your head has to be about Jesus. I have to be clear about that, because there are some people who think that the highest thing in the world you can ever do is think about Jesus. Therefore, the more you think about Jesus, the more spiritual you are. Therefore, you should think about Jesus all day long. But I've over and over again tried to point out to people, if you do that, you're not going to give your employer full value. You're sitting there thinking about Jesus, you're not doing your work. If you take a picture of your wife to work, and put it up in front of you, and you stand there thinking about your wife all day, the poor wife's going to starve pretty soon because you're going to be without a job. If you love her, you put her picture away and work. You understand that? People get so heavenly minded that they're no earthly good. They run around talking about lovely things all the time when they've got a job to do. They've got to earn a living. They've got to give their employer full value. And if this whole country got to be Christian and everybody sat around thinking about Christ, the thing would fall apart even worse than it is. which is pretty bad. You were not saved to spend your life thinking about nice things. You merely were restored to the place of normalcy that God intended for you in the beginning. So what do you do with it? What do we do with our lives? We find out what our talents are and our abilities, and we get a job somewhere and we work. And we earn money and we live. Now, in Paul's day, there were a lot of, this is not a new thing, that people don't want to work. That's been around for a long time. In Paul's day, there were people doing that sort of thing. Their whole life was given to being spiritual, which is nice if you don't have to eat. But Paul said to them in the book of Ephesians, he said, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands, that he may have to give to him that needeth." So he said the people that were just sitting around trying to act spiritual were robbing the rest. Now there's a point at which somebody's going to go into training, and it's true in any profession, law, medicine, whatever, where a man is going to school and he's getting his training and he's working part-time or whatever to get that training, and that's a different thing. But there are lots of people that kind of think, well, if the main purpose of life is spiritual, I'll only work part-time so I can devote the rest of my time to worshiping the Lord. And I'm saying that the practical thing that you do when you say, what do I do with my life now that I'm saved? The practical thing is to find out what your talents are, get a job in that direction if you can, and work a full day shift and give your employer a full day's labor for a full day's wages. And then what you do when you come home after dinner is up to you. But to be involved in secular life, that is to be involved in the matter of just living, is perfectly in keeping with the meaning of our salvation. You see, when Adam was first created, and he had the Spirit of God in him then, he had a job to do. How would you like to take care of a garden that ran from the Mediterranean Sea to the Persian Gulf? It's a pretty big job. The Garden of Eden was the Mesopotamian Valley. Adam and Eve had the task of tending that garden. Now, the reason that they could even come close to doing such a thing is because they were not as limited as we are. Before the fall, Adam and Eve were highly developed beings. Of course, when in the fall, a lot of that was shut down. We're only working with part of a deck right now, if I can use that expression, because, you know, a lot of that was cut out when man fell in the garden. And so God told him that would happen. He said, if you eat this fruit, you're going to be in trouble. Well, they ate it anyway, and they got in trouble. Some people say, well, that's a terrible penalty to put on somebody who eats a piece of fruit. And I have to say to you, suppose the fruit was poison and a doctor said, don't eat that fruit or you're going to die. Well, if somebody takes a bite of the fruit, they're going to die. May seem like an awful penalty, but that's the way it is. That's what life is. But the consequences were severe. Nobody denies that. But so was the act severe, to go against God, you see, to just say, all right, God, I know what you told me, but I'm not going to do it. That's severe. So anyway, the penalty has left us more or less crippled in certain aspects of life ever since. And Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 13 that now we see through the glass darkly. The Greek word there is a word that we get enigma from. That's a puzzle, an enigma. Life is a puzzle. Paul said that. He said, now we see life as a puzzle. We can't figure it out. But then, face to face, now we know in part, but then we shall know as we are known. Now, when we get to heaven, whatever it really is up there, we're not going to line up in long queues waiting to ask God some questions. And people tell me that, you know, well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask God this and this and this. That would be, I mean, you'd need eternity to get through one question session. No, it's not going to be like that. But the moment you hit eternal life, however, in a flash, it's all going to be there. You're going to know it all. You're not going to have to ask. So now we see in part because of the effects of that fall. Okay. So I am saying to you that we're not really yet restored to our place of spiritual sensitivity, but we do have enough recovered to be able to function at a much higher level than we can without the Spirit, without the life of the spirits. We came into the world special creatures, filled with the Spirit of Christ. Now we lost that. We've got it back again in part, but we function in a limited context, and the limits are not in our spirit. The Spirit of Christ in us is the same Spirit. You know what I mean? The Spirit of God, the Spirit of Christ, the Holy Spirit, they're all the same. And that has been with the earth from the beginning of creation. When Christ came, when he came as Jesus, he died, he rose again, and then he came back in spirit form. He came to us. It might be a better way to look at it than to say he sent his spirit. Because the spirit that is in you and me tonight is the spirit of Christ. You see, if you'll understand that, you won't get thrown and confused by all of these nutty ideas about things. So just take the point that the Spirit of Christ comes into you. He came back to us in spirit form now to live in us. We have it better than the disciples did. People might think, I wish I had been around when Jesus was on the earth, because it would be a lot different. Then all my problems, I could go and ask him about them and so forth. Now, you wouldn't even do it then. I've been in the business of counseling, or the process of counseling, for a great many years. And I know something about how readily people follow advice. And I would say, I'll say to you, that if you sat here and counseled with Jesus, you'd go away and do your own thing anyway. Now, because that's the way the human nature is. I mean, look at Peter. Here's Peter, who lived there with Jesus and his disciples for several years. And the minute Jesus is on the witness stand, what does Peter do? He denies him. I never knew the fellow, see? So don't think we'd be any different if Jesus was right in our midst. But we have a more useful involvement with him now because he's come in his spirit to live in our spirits, see? You have Christ within you, in your spirit. Now, as I've said before, I can't locate the spirit for you in the human person. I don't know where it is. And the Bible doesn't tell us where it is. I have my suspicions. I think that it permeates perhaps all of it. I can tell you where the brain is. I can tell you about personality and how it functions to a reasonable degree. None of us know much, but we know something about it. The personality is the sum total of all the behavior patterns that evolve out of your cortex or psyche. And so all that you were born with, all the genes, the traits that you were born with, and all the accumulated practices or habits that you have, that's what your personality is. But I don't know where the spirit is, but it's there. The human spirits is an overriding consciousness. And the Spirit of Christ possesses that human spirit, you see, when we ask him to come in. This idea of the overriding consciousness is pretty substantial. One of the most famous neurosurgeons in the world, Nobel Peace Prize winner, Eccles, wrote a book on the self and its brain. It's about that thick. Is a man who thoroughly supports this idea of an overriding consciousness, which is more than the brain and more than the mind. Now, he doesn't call it God, but it fits readily to this pattern. Now, let us assume that overriding consciousness is our spirit, and let us assume that the spirit of Christ comes to occupy or possess that spirit. Now, you see, we have a sensitivity to us that goes beyond the simple human mentality and personality. But I have to say to you, it does not always immediately change the personality. It may not ever really change the personality. Now, let me go back and pick up the point that we are talking about. What do we do now? We're talking about what is life now. We know where we came from. And we're going to talk again, probably after wait until next week, about where we're going. Because this passage we're talking about says, of him and through him and unto him are all things. What are we doing now? Well, now we live on this earth possessing a mind and a psyche and a personality, all of which are combined, but also in addition to the personality or the psyche, we possess the Spirit of Christ within us. Now, the Spirit of Christ takes our existing psyche, our existing personality, and uses it, works through it to get his job done. Now, you go out to your work. You may be in an office. You may be out in the fields. You may be in an auto shop or something. Whatever you're doing, however secularistic it may seem to you, however much a part of this world process, still, if you think in terms of the fact that you are functioning as your normal self, you're tightening down the lugs, you're hoeing the weeds, you're typing on a typewriter, whatever you're doing, but the Spirit of Christ in your spirit helps you through the day to put together a meaningful life. You're living via your normal psyche, your normal personality, but the Spirit of God is taking these elements, these fragments of knowledge, these personality patterns, and using them in the experiences of your daily life to weave a tapestry of your life. Or, if you will, to paint a painting, either way, whatever you want to say. Now, in any painting, or basically in artwork, especially in a representational painting, you've got to have darks and lights. You've got to have some shadows and some highlights. If you don't, it's not a very interesting painting, usually. But your life has to have darks and lights in it. That's what's going on in you right now. A painting, it's got darks and lights. Now, the canvas is not finished yet. And it may not look very good to people. And they watch the artist put some strokes on the canvas, and they say, boy, that's a terrible thing, you know. Well, wait a minute, wait till we're through with it. And don't look too close. Get back a little ways. There are a lot of strokes that God may lay down on this canvas of ours that are not understandable to us. And they evolve a pattern of darks and lights. Yet the same Spirit is taking all of that, you see, and weaving it into a meaningful tapestry of your life. All that you've ever been in the past, all that you're going to be in the future, all this gets woven into a tapestry laid down on the canvas. And it's a beautiful thing to God. It may not be very beautiful to us, but it's a beautiful thing to God. If you can see the overriding consciousness of your spirit making the brushstrokes out of the stuff of your psyche and your personality, the events of your daily life, then you live with meaning. And it doesn't matter whether you're hoeing weeds or teaching in a classroom or painting or whatever you're doing. All that is there is such a marvelous thing. It may not make sense to anybody else. It may not even look any good to anybody else. We have a book out called The Eagle's Nest, or From the Eagle's Nest, and we've got photographs in that book. We've got pictures. Some of you have seen them, seen the book. Some of you have even read the book. Those pictures in there are deeply meaningful pictures, but they're not your normal cow in the pasture pictures, you know. You got signs and rough buildings and boats and all kinds of things in there. You may know that. But one of the great great impact of those scenes, in a way, is that God takes the stuff of our daily lives and weaves it into a tapestry of great meaning. Your life is not going to be a Garden of Eden. I want you to see that the normal elements of your life, the elements that belong to you for who and what you are taken by God to make something which is beautiful to Him. See, He understands beauty. He may find beauty in an old sign somewhere, in a rock or an alley. You go on with your work every day. You are making that tapestry in your daily life, whatever you're doing. When the people in Corinth asked Paul about this matter, you know, what shall we do now that we're saved? See? Now that we have Christ in our heart, what do? We go sit in a meeting hall all day or just what? And he said, do whatever you're doing now. If you're a slave, don't seek to be free. If you're a free man, don't seek to be a slave. Don't just come in and change all your life things just because you're now filled with the Spirit of Christ. Just go on with what you've got, and He'll take whatever you are and make it into a beautiful tapestry for Him. You say, where are you going? Well, I'm going right where I said I was going. He says, all of our life on this earth is through Him. And I'm saying to you, He takes the diverse elements of our personality and our experiences and our circumstances and makes out of them something beautiful to Him. But don't you get in there and try to stir it all up. Just leave it alone. Just go on. You took Christ into your spirit today. Tomorrow you do what you did today. You did what you did yesterday. Just do your work. If the Lord has something different for you to do, He'll make it known to you. If you're in bad circumstances, don't just try to work your way out of them real fast. Don't ask Him to now change everything for you. Just start where you are and live every day and let the master artist take the elements of your psyche and your circumstances and make of that something for His glory. Because you see, an artist can take anything they've got. He can take tin cans and rocks and sticks and everything else. An artist can take that stuff and make something beautiful out of it. I want us to really nail this down tight. Don't you dare go out and try to be a Christian. Now that might send a shock wave through some people's lives. Don't try to be a Christian. Just be you. Just be you. Your personality is there and probably going to pretty much remain the way it is, with modifications that help you to be a little less ornery, perhaps. Extroverts are extroverts. Introverts are introverts. Mesoverts are mesoverts. You don't know what a mesovert is, a middle person. An introvert means somebody that is inward. The inferiority complex is an expression of introverted personality. There's nothing wrong with being introvert, except or unless you carry introversion to the point of an escape mechanism, a defense mechanism. Nothing wrong with defense mechanisms per se. What is wrong is carrying defense mechanisms out to absurdity, you see. For example, you try to defend yourself. There's a certain thing called self-respect. If you get into an argument with somebody, the most important thing to you is not so much the truth as it is saving significance for your psyche, for your person, you see. Save respect. If you want to learn how to handle arguments and come out the best in it, learn to give the other person room to save their self-respect. You have to. You have to defend your ego, your psyche. There's nothing wrong with defending your psyche. Mental breakdowns are often expressed by persons who suddenly feel so totally nothing and all their defenses are gone and they stand completely naked before the world. In fact, some of them take their clothes off and run out in the street. Why do they do that? Because they suddenly have lost all their defense mechanisms. They have no defenses left. And that's the way they express that. There's nothing wrong with a defense mechanism if it has to do with the idea of self-respect. Now, of course, the Christian will come along and say, oh, that's terrible, you've got to be humble and so forth. And I have to say to you that God has plenty of ways of keeping us humble. For some people, humility is a fact of life. For some people, it's a virtue, humility. But for most of us, it's sort of a fact of life. Given the circumstances and psyche, probably humility is pretty well warranted. There's nothing wrong with being introvertive if you don't withdraw within yourself and shut everybody out. Then you become, you carry it to what we call escapism. You don't want to do that. There's nothing wrong with being extrovertive if you don't carry it to the point of projectionism where you hurt other people. But you see, if you become a Christian and you think that the presence of the Spirit of Christ is going to suddenly make you into an extrovert so that you rush around telling everybody, you're missing the reality of life. I think the only people that think everybody ought to be a big mouth in the world are people who have one. It's easy for them. You know what I mean? To suddenly become the great outgoing promoter of the gospel or something just because you have the Spirit of Christ in you is faulty. It doesn't jive with the Word of God either. So if you're a quiet type of person and you're reticent, you're not eager to impose on people, welcome to the club. There are a lot of us in it. I'm in that club too. So what I want to get across to you is don't feel that because your life right now is different than the good people's life, than the spiritual people, don't worry about it. Just be who you are and what you are right now. If God has a way to work and change you, let him do it. But you didn't ask to be born the way you were. Whatever you are, and whatever is added then by way of environment, parents and whatnot, I mean the parental actions, parental discipline and so forth. So by the time you're 5 years old, for the most part, you're pretty well set. Your psyche is set. To change it requires sometimes rather radical surgery. It takes place. Changes come. But they come on the heels of traumatic experiences. Usually, they don't usually come in terms of someone trying to shape you up. If you go around trying to shape people up and make them like you, many pastors do that. They come in with a hammer and chisel, try to change everybody. Or they come in with a stamping machine, make gumdrops out of everybody. Everybody's got to act alike, think alike. Everybody's got to say the same thing and act the same way. And you're going to a meeting, everybody's doing the same thing. If you're not doing it, you're a dumbo, you're sitting there. I'm trying to give you the feeling here of self-worth or sensitivity, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's the normal human thing, to recognize that there's some value to you as you are. In the first place, don't look at other people and try to be like they are. In the second place, don't let other people try to tell you who you ought to be. They don't know anything about who you ought to be. It's amazing to me how quickly people want to tamper with somebody's psyche. I think it's unconscionable. I think it is almost criminal. The way well-meaning but ill-informed Christians often go around trying to badger people into being what they are or what they want to be personally. Leave people alone. You may think you're God's right hand, but leave people alone. You may think they'll go to hell if you don't talk to them. Leave them alone. If the Spirit of the Lord brings you together with somebody and you're able to help them, that's beautiful. But don't go out with a hatchet trying to batter everybody into the shape you think they ought to be. Now, I say that not believing that anybody in this room does that. But if somebody tries it on you, tell them to drop dead. That's right. Tell them to leave you alone. Somebody sidles up to you and says, you ought to come over here because this will be better for you. You don't have enough. You're not getting the best teaching there. Just tell them to beat it. You're all right. You try to be kind to them, they won't let you, so don't worry about that. Now, you see, it gets serious when these self-styled sculpturers so interfere with people that they start committing suicide. Or they wind up in a mental hospital. You pull somebody's struts out from under them and they can wind up in a mental hospital. I've had to say to a lot of people, would you let your relative take your appendix out? Well, no. Then why do you let them tamper with your psyche? It takes a great amount of sensitivity. It takes the Spirit of Christ in us. But it also takes a little training, a little knowledge that Christ provides some with, but not everybody. So just don't go out with a gospel and batter people with it like a club. Well, I'm going to have to stop here.